Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. An introduction that reminds me of a childhood television program whose name I cannot remember, but that greeting is still stuck in my mind. I recall the main character always, or one of the characters in the show rather. Maybe it was Horrible Histories or something like that. On the CBBC network in the UK, would use that language, and it's still there in my mind. I wonder how many of those kind of utterances from children's television are deep in the depths of my mind that are to one day be remembered. I recall. I suppose that one is one that fits in more seamlessly into the regular conversation. I recall Basil Brush saying boom boom a lot, but I think it was like an utterance of excitement. And the theme tune of the Arthur television show, all of these things, they just come back quite vividly. It was the case that in the morning before going to school, I would watch shows like Arthur, that was what was available on the television. So I would get ready, I would have television on in the background, or I might sit and watch a program, and then I would go to school. Things are different now. I was told, and I think I've blogged about this in the past, that I had a getting old moment when I was reflecting on the changing nature of media for younger people, where there's so much choice now, in the form of YouTube and such, and CBBC in particular in the UK is going online only in a few years. I guess technology is much more abundant now, but certainly something will be lost, and I'm not, technology changes things, I guess. So there's that, but for this show, I had nothing in particular on my mind. One thing that I've been thinking about, in fact, I was just reading a blog post about this, was static websites. The idea of having a website that contains files that are on your file system, and whenever you make an amendment to your site, such as adding a new page or changing the header or creating and writing a blog post, say you regenerate your website into this static folder of pages. And one thing I like about this pattern is the pattern I use on my blog is that is the kind of speed there and the reliability. A static folder of pages is much easier to assure the quality of, I guess, than say a dynamic website, especially with all the things I've built over time. Like my website's experimental. I'm adding new things. Sometimes I'm creating new page types like maps, and there have been varying kinds of ideas that I've explored there. With the static site, I don't have to worry about like a database query making pages unavailable. It's kind of failing back quite well, where if the page doesn't render properly, at least there's something there. And I've never really run into a case where content has been entirely broken. Although there was one case where I published a blog post and all of the posts on my homepage disappeared, and I had no idea what had happened. And it turns out I'd been editing a template, one of the parent templates on this site. I made a syntax error, and then that caused issues. But those are few and far between. I use my site as an opportunity to learn how to build a static site generator. It's often the case that I'm exploring technologies that interest me in my spare time because I want to know how they work and to learn. And I'm gonna take a sip of water here. I want to know how they work, and to learn and to kind of push the boundaries of it. So my site has always been, in that respect, a playground. And I used to spend a lot of time documenting new features on my site, and I still do. where there was this kind of flywheel of I made a new feature, I documented it, and then I got excited about like what else could I do with my site, and then I would keep doing that, and that led to a lot of interesting projects. Like I've had dark modes file or JavaScript file that you can put on your own website. It's a single file, and you can use it to integrate progressively enhanced dark mode onto your site. Where progressively enhanced means if a user doesn't have JavaScript enabled, if the script fails to load for any reason, your site will still appear as you would like it, albeit not with the dark mode capability. And that's a feature I thought a lot about when building my site, progressive enhancement. How can I make sure that if a user chooses not to use JavaScript, or if it doesn't load for some reason, or indeed, and this is the primary case, if somebody has, say, poor internet connection, and they still want to browse my site, I don't want a dependence on JavaScript to inhibit one's ability to explore. I still haven't quite figured out the offline modes. I really would like to do that. Surface workers, I haven't quite got my head around how they work. I just know they're really powerful. But it would be kind of cool. I know that Jeremy Keefe at Adactio.com has some scripts for making your website offline, and I'm sure that if you go to his site and load a few pages, then you go offline, you can still see some of the old pages because they've been cached on your device. And I love that. Speaking as someone who can be, I know, going out in the countryside and there's poor cell reception. That's the American term. I guess mobile phone service is the more British one, I guess. But yeah. I may be loading a website now and have to refresh a few times, and I'm out of range and I can't use it. Whereas I would like to enable an experience on my site where if you are out of cell range, you could still read some contents. There's a lot of possibilities there. Maybe I don't know, load the homepage and all the pages you've been to, and maybe cache a couple other blog posts, so that just in the background, so that if you come to my site, you know that there are a few pieces of content that you haven't read, that you could still read, and that would help pass the time when you are out of range and don't have a robust mobile connection. I really need to explore this more. But yeah, back to the idea of static sites. This blog post, which I'll put in the show notes, made a really interesting point in the data portability component of having a static website, where that you're not locked into any particular platform. So as long as you're using technologies that aren't platform dependent, then you're able to just move your site over to different environments when you need to. And that flexibility is excellent for longevity. I see static sites kind of having a big impact in archiving, for example. Building these robust, long-term readable resources that allow you to that allow you the longer access and a kind of greater assurance that the data is there, I guess. That's not the best way of saying it, but yeah, you can move your data around and you can kind of take your site where it needs to go. Which is a really interesting idea. And I think in most circumstances, that doesn't really matter. I've had my site on the same server for years now, and everything has worked fine. But with that said, if I were to move, it would be the case of downloading the source code for the site, running a Python script, and then after installing all the dependencies, I am not sure if I've got a dependency requirements file set up properly. Maybe I do, but it's a bit out of date. But anyway, I would install dependencies, and I could run and get the site set up again. I'm running a a fairly standard setup in terms of web hosting. So I have a server that uses Nginx for the web component, and I have, and this is the non-standard part, the custom static site generator, which all feeds into a folder. With that said, though, I do use GitHub's Actions product, and I have been for maybe about a year and a half now, where I make a commit to my site's Git repository, and then the site is generated on GitHub Actions. It's then zipped up, and then uses the secure copy command to move the HTML and the images and such to my server, which is a really nice flow. You can do all this, I believe, with like Git hooks and such, but that's getting a bit too far into the weeds for me. GitHub Actions, it took a little while to set up, but there is a robust community there of people who have already written actions that you can use and reuse and tailor to your needs. So yeah, that's a brief history of how my site works. I really do love the static pattern. I've used Jekyll. I'm using 11t for a couple projects now, including the website for my programming language, VisionScript. 11t was sort of my go-to choice there because I know that with minimal configuration, I can get a static site going. I really don't know much about 11t, but I've been able to build some really cool sites with fairly minimal overhead. I make a template, and I'm using the templating language with which I'm familiar. Maybe there's differences, but I use Jinja 2 in Python, and the syntax seems to be the same in 11t. Maybe it's not 100% parity, but I've been able to get really far with the knowledge I have, and just an 11t configuration file, and then the front matter pattern where you have like metadata about a file at the top with like the page title and a description and maybe a header image and all of these things. And 11t really does work nicely. The creator, Zach Lederman, has an amazing personal website, and has created some great components just for the open web. He's got an avatar service, he built a screenshot service. I think he's even, I need to check on this, but I think he's experimented too with sparkle lines. These little lines, line graphs that you can draw that don't have any axes, and they're more used to, I guess, indicate trend. Trends, or at least directionality, if that's a word. So like trending up, down. I have a few of my site's homepage that show how many posts I've done and how many contributions I've made to the IndieWeb Wiki, which I really like seeing those charts. And yeah, it's interesting because sometimes like the charts can be like fairly up and down, with not quite consistency, but like a discernible pattern. When I say write one post every few days, and then sometimes there's big spikes when I write a lot and I've got all these ideas on my mind, and then they sort of fizzle out. It's never so much about the numbers, because the spark lines don't show numbers. It's just they show you those trends. And yeah, it's always nice when I can go to my site homepage and like that information isn't really available anywhere else. How it works is I'm not sure if interesting is the right word. I wouldn't quite say arcane, but I m my site generator builds a list of numbers, and the list of numbers refers to the number of posts written on each day in the last 90 days, and then that is put through a special SVG file from Stuart Langridge. And then that creates the sparkline, which means that the sparkline doesn't change into like publish a new blog post, or make another change to my site, because the site has to be rebuilt. But I also have those on my category pages too, so you can see trends in the categories. I suspect if you went to the coffee one right about now, there wouldn't be too many there. Although I have been meaning to to get back into coffee a bit more. I usually go out for coffee now, and I love just going to a cafe and having a pour over or cappuccino. But I used to make a lot of coffee at home, particularly, in fact, excuse me, I started during the pandemic, but now I don't make so much. And I don't think there was any particular reason. I guess I sort of I took a break, then I forgot some of the like the settings that I'd learned about and kind of not quite configuration, that's a software term, like the procedure used to, or recipe, yes, the recipe used to brew a cup of coffee. Maybe I should brew one after this call, podcast. My goodness, okay. Interesting. Interesting whirlwind of language. And indeed, whirlwind of language would be an interesting a blog name for a blog about language. Speaking of which, earlier this week at the IndieWeb Homebrew Website Club, we got into a discussion about typography, and one of the realms that we explored per se was interesting. I've said the word interesting a lot this podcast, and when I say interesting, I really do mean interesting. It's a word that I use with almost passion. And there's not really a good synonym at the top of my mind. In any case, we were talking about typography, and we find all these interesting Unicode symbols. One looked like it was two dots with a line beneath it. And I think it comes from German grammar. And then there was another that was like an equal sign on a slant. That equal sign on a slant was used when a line breaks when a line breaks on a hyphen. So you know how in text, like if a word is too long for a line, it will break with a hyphen. If you broke a word that already has a hyphen on the hyphen, you would use this kind of equal sign that's pointed up to the right. Like Machiavellian-esque, for example, that hyphen there, esque, is important. If you were to break it on that hyphen, then you would insert one of these grammar marks. I am curious about how many of these rare, well, I guess. Grammar marks with which I'm not familiar and haven't seen at all in writing. How many I could try and use? People would, of course, question. And that's the interesting thing about language is, language, of course, has principle. Well, not so much principles, but practices to which one adheres depending on. Like, say, if you're a journalist, you will have a strict style guide to which you adhere, and editors will ensure conformance to that, so that the publication is all following roughly the same style. And depending on the discipline, of course, whether it be opinion or investigative and so on. But in any case, there's usually that baseline like style guide. And so, yeah, I think using some of these rarer marks would elicit questions like, what does that mean? And sure, it would prompt curiosity, which is why I'd be tempted to try and figure them out, and like figure out how to use one or two of them in my writing. On the other hand, though, the knowledge seems, for some of the rarer punctuation marks, it seems to be rare enough that people might just gloss over it, and it would lead to the reader having less comprehension over the text because they start to think about what does this grammar mark mean? When I guess the ones that we have right now in terms of like full stops and colons, semicolons, inverted commas, and quotation marks, all of these in primary school they were articulated as sort of a pyramid where you would over the years leap up to the next stage of the pyramid and gradually gain greater fluency over language, and then I think like the asterisk was closer to the top and such. But These marked like this equal sign to a slant, which I can't even recall the name. It was oblique something something. They weren't on the pyramid, and they've never come up in conversation until this week, which is to say that there may indeed be cases where using these marks is proper. I think one of them that we were reading about was used specifically in dictionaries. And so maybe some of these are context specific, which is interesting. So that's I guess the deep dive into language and, well, grammar and how we communicate more broadly too. Using rare punctuation marks probably isn't going to get you very far, unless you do want to prompt curiosity. But it takes, not everybody is going to see a punctuation mark and say, "I'm going to Google that." And even then, some of these that we were looking at, if you sometimes Google just would struggle with them. Sometimes it got them, but like if you were to combine two marks, that Google just would return a page of the most generic results, like in news sites or whatever, just like nothing to do with your query. And I'm not really sure why. I don't know enough about text encoding, and it feels like a rabbit hole. With that said, though, given that we're talking about grammar, and also these are all Unicode characters, I shouldn't note the idea that's been on my mind for years, but that has never come to fruition. The cappuccino emoji, about which I have written a blog post, but I would love for the Unicode Consortium to release a cappuccino emoji. There is the black coffee emoji right now, or I think they call it hot beverage, but it looks like coffee. But I also would like there to be a coffee with milk emoji. I guess the case I'm making is that everyone takes their coffee differently, and I'd like to be able to indicate my coffee preference. I do actually prefer black coffee, but being able to put in a milky coffee emoji, if I was having a cappuccino, like this coffee is great, milky coffee emoji. I don't know. Maybe it's too close to the current hot beverage emoji. And indeed, maybe the name needs some work too, because maybe it should be coffee with milk or hot beverage with milk. Because, there will be cultural differences there, and perhaps different names used to refer to the beverage. And indeed, that a whole separate discussion is what constitutes each different drink. What is a cappuccino? What's a latte? A subject that I've never really delved into, because you can be pedantic and refer to like the third rule of a cappuccino, like one third milk, one third coffee, one third foam, or you can base it off your experience. And I hear varying degrees of these things. Maybe about a month and a half ago, I ordered a cup of coffee. I ordered a flat white, and I got it in a small cup, and that's expected for flat white. But the small cup wasn't even full. And I'm not one to kind of question the size of a flat white, because I expect it to be smaller. But this was the smallest flat white I've ever had. And the person had come from Australia. And that was the practice that they had learned. That was how they made flat whites. They believed it to be a shorter, sharper drink, with that milk to help accompany the drink to make it smoother. That honestly, the coffee was great, but I don't think there will ever be an answer to what constitutes each drink. I think we have guidelines like a flat white is smaller, stronger, cappuccino is foamier, and then a latte is milkier with less foam. Although I would defer to a barista to render their own opinion with regard to what constitutes each drink. And that's not even to mention like the piccolos and the and of course you've got the espresso and the lungo and the ristretto. You don't see that one very often. That's a restricted espresso. And surely there are other drinks too. I'm sure Blue Bottle also made one up too. The American coffee company, who in San Francisco, when I was there earlier this year, made some of the best coffee I've ever had. It was truly amazing. I didn't care too much for the almost like, I don't know, the store sort of felt like they lacked character. I understand that was what the founder, James, well, James Freeman, the founder, was inspired by, I believe, Japan and this focus on the quality of the coffee and the simple aesthetic. But I felt like something was lacking there, which I don't know, every coffee shop defines their own experience, but it doesn't happen very often, but sometimes when I'm in a coffee shop, I think this place lacks character, no matter how great the coffee is. Where character, I guess, is defined by more colors or a warmer feeling, or even like there being more conversation in the background. Whereas when I was in Blue Bottle, on one occasion, like there were business people there, and it was rainy in the morning, and it didn't really feel too warm, and a lot of people just ordered drinks for the there must be an app that you can download, and just walked in and out and collected their coffees. Indeed, that happens here too, like in say Starbucks, where you can get a mobile order. But yeah, I do like it when cafes feel warmer. And yeah, I believe that's all I have for this episode. So thank you so much for listening. It's been a pleasure having you as a listener, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.